Because our dear brother Surya is Indian body, but someone who's spent a lot of his life outside. He's worked for, he's a computer guy. He's not just a programmer. He's like what we call a computer scientist. So he's one of those mysterious beings that actually create the mumbo jumbo that everybody else uses to create things like Google. So Surya, I know when I first met him, he was working for the Boeing Corporation, making sure that the planes that you may have come on actually fly. But he now heads a research organization out on the west coast of America, and his head is fully into very, very cerebral things. But he is at the same time, and has been for many years, a yogi. And I can't figure out whether it's his feet or his brain, one or the other, is firmly rooted in this spiritual understanding. And so he is going to, in a sense, continue our conversation that Neville began, and let us now sit down, relax, and enjoy the next 40 minutes with Surya Bhai. Good morning.
Good morning once again. Can you all hear me? Okay. So it's lovely to be with all of you this morning, and I feel particularly fortunate to have heard Neville's presentation. He has actually covered a lot of wonderful ground and also stirred up your thinking minds and touched your hearts, both of them I could see. And he actually made my task a little lighter in the sense that I don't need to cover all the bigwigs in the field, what they have been saying and how it all falls together. It was a very, very wonderful compilation and summarization of the state of the art as well as the state of the heart in terms of who we really are. What I'll try to do is try to do something a little more humble, little smaller, probably more to the ground, probably more in line with what traditional scientists think in terms of this topic of science and spirituality. Okay? So please bear with me as I go along and as I build this story of what's the relationship between these two things. So science, as we all know, is one of the major forces in the world today. It's called one of the authorities. And the other authority is religion. They are typically considered to be two separate worlds. They are basically worlds apart because people say that they deal with two different things altogether. Okay? In fact, in one of the Future of Power programs in the past, when I attended one in Mumbai, one gentleman from a business background, he was saying, they have nothing in common. And I understand that very well. I don't see the face here, but it's easy to see why people think that way. Science helps us understand a few things. I'll just list them up just to put you in the context from which I am coming. It helps us understand the physical structure of the universe, the forces that exist in nature, the laws that govern the various interactions, use mathematics and equations. It deals with quantifiable stuff, it's objective, and deals with, so to say, facts. This is basically the world of science, as we typically understand. Religion, on the other side, it deals with human values, morals, what's right, what's wrong, meanings, whether it's semantics or the purpose of life and things of that nature. It's typically non-quantifiable. So let me give you an example. You can say, give me 10 kilograms of gold. You can't say, give me 10 kilograms of love. Right? Is there any quantification for it? You'll probably use a degree, say, more love, less love, but there is no quantity that you can ascribe to. We don't even have units to describe them in. Okay? So that's more or less already setting aside that this world that we're dealing with, with precise quantities and mathematical equations actually is not the world we are dealing with on this side. And it's subjective. It's not only not quantifiable, it's subjective. It comprises of beliefs. And in summary, if I have to put one word to it, this aspect deals with what is called behavior. Okay? The human being, what we think, what we do, what's right, what's wrong, morality, immorality, all these concepts, they are all concerned with behavior. Whereas this is all concerned primarily with matter. This is how we perceive these two worlds. Okay? So now, if we look at science, it has positives. So for example, today, our longevity has increased. People live for much longer, and lots of diseases which they used to think were curses can now be cured with medicines, which is a product of science. So I just listed a few of them for us to keep this in mind, that it can bring so many benefits. So on the health field, we see that in transportation, you want to fly from one side of the world to another side of the world, you can do that today, and things are getting faster and faster. Supersonic transfer, for example, transport. And communication. Okay, think about 10, 15 years ago versus now. You can see your daughter living in another corner of the world, not just hear them, but you can actually see them speak. So it's integrating people together. Communication has become better. Comfort. We control the environment. If it's too hot, we turn the air conditioner on. And then we are the masters of the environment. So it gives comfort in our lives as well. This is not an exhaustive list, but it's just a list to highlight that there are so many benefits that come from this. But at the same time, there are also a lot of negatives that science brings. And while I do this, actually, let me explain this to you. Because of a certain bodily condition I'm going through, I have a problem with the dryness of the mouth. So I'll once in a while keep taking a swig. So I ask for your forgiveness that I'm allowed to do this. Thank you. Now, on the negative side, we have things like physical weapons, with which now lots of havoc is being created around the world. Mass shooting in California recently. Nuclear weapons. Paris as well, not to forget. Nuclear weapons. So weapons of mass destruction are a byproduct of science too. Science has created this mentality of individualism. You know, I exist and whatever I need is basically the primary focus that's created by science. Materialism, everything that exists that I can touch, that I can use, is basically all that matters. Greed, I don't have to tell you about this, just look at the financial scandals and everything. Obscenity, again, I just used a generic term, I think you understand where I'm coming from. And obscenity is spreading widely also, very easily with the tools of science. Erosion of moral values, we see this quite a lot. And think of the Nirbhaya case that has happened in Delhi. And it shows how much below animalistic behavior humans are actually coming down to. And then insecurity of various kinds. Okay? And this is at every level, at family level, at the individual level, at the societal level, at the national level, there's insecurity everywhere. So that in America, there is a new department that has been created, which is called Department of Homeland Security. That's a new department. So lack of security everywhere. Now, we think science brings advantage, but here is an example. See, in olden days, if you had a fort is supposed to be a place where you're comfortable. If you are inside a fort, nobody can touch you. Okay? So there's very strong walls around the fort, but they also used to have what's called a moat. This thing is called a moat. Okay? And there would be crocodiles or alligators or whatever, so people can't actually even cross it. So if you wanted to be safe, all you needed to do was draw this bridge, cut yourself off from the rest of the world, and you're safe and comfortable. Those were the good old days. But now what happens? Think of a cannon, which is a product of science. It sits outside and then it starts blasting that castle that is in there. You're already starting seeing that I'm not secure anymore. But just as you're seeing now in countries like Syria, you can actually, somebody in another part of the world could actually just launch a missile by pressing a button and then it'll go and hit. it'll go and hit an object which is somewhere else in another part of the world. So if you're sitting in that castle and it's in the way of some missile, then you're not safe anymore. So what happened to your security? Science did give you all those comforts, but what happened to the security? Well, even if you have a moat around you, if somebody else has a remote in their hands, your moat is of no use. Okay? So that's where it went. Similarly, science and privacy. I'm just highlighting a couple of aspects just to tell you where it is taking us. So here is a family, wonderful, beautiful family with kids and parents and so on. They're having a private time with their family. And this particular piece of land that you are seeing, imagine it in the middle of 100 acres of land that they own. Which means that where they are, there is no human being in sight. Nobody can actually even look at them. They're right in the middle of a 100 acre lot. You understand? Okay, now what's coming up? Look at this object in here. You know what this is called? It's called a drone. So the moment a drone has come, your total privacy is gone. Okay, somebody can send a drone and see what actually is happening with you. Your privacy is completely taken away. Here is another example. This fellow is having a very nice sleep in his apartment, which is in the 100th floor of a beautiful, probably Manhattan building or whatever, with a very nice view and scenario all around from his pad out there. And there's a drone flying at that 100-story level and peeking into his bedroom. And this is a reality. People are trying to fight this now. What am I trying to tell you? What I'm trying to tell you is while science can give us a lot of great things, science not used in the right way can also create lots of new problems that did not even exist before. You're all with me on this?
Yeah.
So we need something that reigns in science. We need something that will blunt the edge of all these negative things that science can bring. But sometimes the analogy is given that science is like a knife. Now, is a knife good thing or a bad thing?
Good thing.
It's a good thing. Many of you seem to think it's a good thing. Who thinks it's a bad thing? Some think it's bad, right? You think it's bad? No? It's good? Only good? Okay. So in reality, the answer is that it's neither good nor bad. If you use it for cutting your vegetables, it's a good thing. If you use it for cutting somebody else's throat, it's a bad thing. So it's in the hands of the person who is using it. So science is like that. It's a tool, but in the right hands, it gives benefit. In the wrong hands, it brings harm. Okay? So this is where how science gets used actually becomes critical. So what is the other thing which can help us? Rein in the behavior and the usage of science that is at our disposal today. And that is where religion comes into picture. Okay? So now religion has positives too. And I use the words religion and spirituality a little bit interchangeably, although they are not identical. I hope by the end of the presentation that will be clear to you. But this thing in general gives us inner comfort, it gives us morality, right and wrong, doing good, being good, and so on and so forth. Lots of good. But at the same time, it also brings things like superstition, blind faith, division, means I belong to this and you belong to that, communal disharmony, fights among communities, narrow-mindedness, if you are not one of us, then you are against us. And then rituals, which probably have no benefit, probably. But people hang on to these things very strongly because it sort of appeals to something that is deep inside them. You can't reason with it. Okay? So while religion can bring these good things, it also has negatives in there. Now the question is, we want these goods because the positives of religion is saying that this is good, this is not good. You know, don't harm anybody, don't steal something. Don't create violence. Those are the things that we need to govern the behavior of what is going to be done with science. So we need that good part, but we don't want the bad part. And so similarly for science, we need the good part of its good application, but not the bad part. Now what's the solution? The solution then is considered to be to take the best of both worlds. Means take the good positives from both, That means take the good from the spirituality side and guide the science as to what you should do with it. And then reject the negatives from both, particularly reject notions like religion, but hone in, embrace spirituality. So if you do that, then you actually get rid of the bad parts. Now the question is, how do you bring both of them together? Okay? So this need for combining the two to actually make progress happen has been recognized a long time ago. We are not the first ones talking about it. And to show you an interesting quotation from one of the most famous scientists that we know of, Albert Einstein. This doesn't always come in. Science is not so reliable always, right? So this is a quote from Albert Einstein which says, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." And for both of them to actually bring benefit, the combination has to be used. Just like this blind man here is actually carrying the lame man who cannot walk on his head. The lame can see but cannot move. The blind can move but cannot see. So by the combination of them, they actually help each other to move forward and get something done. So this was an analogy. It's a pictorial depiction of the statement that Einstein made. This was made, you know, when the nuclear bombs were used in the last century. And that was, 1936 was the invention of nuclear bombs, and 1942 was the first use of it. And many scientists, including Einstein, Oppenheimer, who was the head of the nuclear project, and so on and so forth, they all said, this is going to be destruction of humanity, we can't go on this way. Okay? So that's when they started saying this, and a peace movement was formed around the world, saying that we need to somehow rein in this science by complementing it with spiritual values, so to say. I'm just using a general expression. Because they didn't actually prescribe religion per se. They were saying, think of human values, think of moral values, think of being good. Okay? That's what they meant. But this was 80 years ago when they did it. And many people received even Nobel Prizes for leading that peace movement, peaceful usage of scientific technology, science and technology. But let's look now 80 years on. How is the world today? Is it any safer than in 1942? Are we closer to destruction or are we further away from destruction? We're closer. So this thing that when science and religion or science and spirituality come together will bring us harmony, actually did not. It remained a slogan. It didn't work. So something else needs to happen. And that's exactly the theme that I'm going to cover in the next set of slides. I'm just setting the context until now as to where we stand together with regards to these two authorities. Science on one side and the spirituality or religion on the other side. Now I'll actually present to you what I think is happening and where science is looking at and how the science and spirituality can come together. So I'll now go to the crux of my presentation. So we have science and spirituality, and from Einstein's time onwards, from the nuclear bomb's time onwards, there was this feeling that they should come together and they should become partners. And as I just now mentioned, 80 years of these slogans did not really get us anywhere. Now there are more nuclear weapons. Now there are more crazy uses of technologies. Now there is more insecurity. Now there are more problems and all sorts of things. So we are not really getting anywhere with this kind of a slogan saying, let's be partners to make something happen. Can something different happen? I think it can, and I think it's happening now. And that's the part that I would like to emphasize with. What really needs to happen is not just partnership, but there needs to be an overlap. What does an overlap mean? An overlap means there is a common set of understanding which is common to both science side as well as the spirituality side. So what does that mean? So this region in here, the overlap region, is basically where science meets the spirituality. It's not just handshake, that there is a common set of understanding which is uniform to both science as well as spirituality. And my thesis is that until that happens, really science and spirituality cannot be partners. And I'm going to present to you that this indeed is really happening now. And so what I'll be sharing with you is developments in the field of science, the latest developments in thinking, that is actually somehow making us understand things in a way that science and spirituality become not just complementary, but they become overlapping, unifying theme for truth. So let me explain this to you further. So we have science and we have spirituality. And typically we think that spirituality can guide science. You know, you say, you should not be violent, you should not be stealing, you should not be doing all those things. So you can apply science in such a way that it only brings the benefit. So we understand this equation very well. We understand that from spiritual values or moral values, we can guide science. Are all of you with me in this statement? This is something we understand very easily. But what we don't understand is that while science can be guided by spirituality and it can help it, we have no way of understanding how science can actually help spirituality. So the reason why we did not make progress in the 80 years, why there was further deterioration in spite of the slogans, is because spirituality can guide science, but what has been happening to spirituality? It has been becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. Why? Because we have drowned more and more in materialism, in individualism, in the things that science was telling us, these are all things that exist. So spirituality got weaker and weaker, so the controlling power which could have controlled science was becoming weaker. So the benefit was not coming, although it should come. So now if I really want to make things work, I have to somehow reinforce this spirituality. And the novel theme that I am going to share with you now is that in reality there's only one thing that can help spirituality to become stronger again. And you know what it is? Science. And the thing is, how? So let me share with you a few highlights as to how a new thing is happening, which is where science is now coming back and say, this is how spiritually the truths are, and that's where we should be thinking about. Okay, so before I go ahead with the real results, the hardcore results from the science area, let me give you an example, two very simple examples to bring you up in the same frame of mind. For example, as I grew up, parents used to tell children, don't smoke. Yes? We hear that a lot of the time, right? Parents don't want children to smoke. And what does the child do? Child goes away here and there and then, you know, goes to school and smokes with kids and comes back, tells lies to the parents, all that stuff. I'm just using one typical case. Okay? When the parents are telling the children not to smoke, the children saw, you know, parents thought it's a very wrong thing, it's a bad habit to smoke. And the children were thinking, this fellow is coming and constraining me. He doesn't understand, it's a hip thing, it's cool to smoke. Like my friends smoke and I want to smoke too. What's wrong with it? I'm just smoking. But in the early 1990s, certain scientific results started becoming openly available. They were actually available in the 60s, but the companies, because of their greed, did not want it to come out. And in the 1990s, the research that was done with regards to what happens when one smokes started getting published outside openly. And so now it's common knowledge that if somebody smokes, it's very likely that they will get cancer. Okay? So now you go and tell the same kid, you want to die at 30 years of age, go smoke as much as you want. What does that fellow do? He will think twice at least before he does it. Okay? So remember, what has changed in the boy? His behavior has changed. Behavior was the domain of what? Was the domain of religion before. But now the scientific fact is helping the fellow follow what was previously thought to be like a dogma from the parent to say, don't smoke. So what I'm trying to tell you, here's one example where science can actually tell us there is something beneficial for you in understanding this and understanding the consequences. And when we understand that, then our behavior automatically changes. Now let me take yet one more example just to cement this in a different way, because this is an example which really touched my heart. Now one of the most famous neurobiologists who is working in understanding how the brain is and how everything is working in the brain, his name is Christoph Koch. He was a professor at Caltech University in California, and he has been hired as the chief scientist by an institution in Seattle. It's called Allen's Institute of Brain Sciences. That was founded by Paul Allen, who was the co-founder, along with Bill Gates, of Microsoft. He's a billionaire. And he decided that he wanted research to be done on the brain and then find out all the methods by which we can eliminate all the brain-related diseases for the benefit of humanity, philanthropic work. And he is spending only $400 million, which is basically 2,000 crores on that activity. It's called a brain map project. Okay, now this gentleman, Christof Koch, worked with another person called Francis Crick. And Francis Crick is a Nobel Prize winner, biologist, and he is famous for co-discovering the DNA. You all understand DNA? Huh? Wherever you go, you can't live without DNA these days, right? For everything that you say, do, and exist, they're saying, we want your DNA, and we'll know everything about you. So it's such a fundamental discovery. And Christof Koch worked with Francis Crick, and both of them wanted to address this challenge, how does the brain produce consciousness? So they worked together on it. And while doing that research, Christof Koch was doing experiments on a lot of animals, and they would, you know, trisect the brains of the animals under different circumstances and do all kinds of tests to figure out the mechanisms of the brain. While he was doing that, he observed something very interesting. He found that the structures of the human brain are similar to the structures found in other animals also, all across the spectrum. Okay, not just mammals, but also other kinds of animals, whether it is lizards, whether it's something else. So the structure of the brain is the same. And they were coming from the view that the brain is what is creating consciousness. So human brain is very unique, has a very big what's called neocortex, which I'll talk about a little later. And therefore, we can think, feel, experience, talk, and all these things. Animals, nah, they don't have this, so they don't have any of that stuff. But when we started examining the brains of all the animals, and we found that there were similar things, even if in different size, in the animals, it made him think, oh my God, if I can think and feel and experience all these things, if I can experience pain, then this animal would also be able to experience pain because it has a similar brain, even if it is in different proportions. That realization led that scientist to change. You know what he did? Can you guess what he did? He became a vegetarian. Today, as one of the topmost scientists in the field who can authoritatively talk about the brain structure and how it works, he also says, when I studied it, I found that the brain is similar in animals too. So they will have similar experiences that I have. So he said, how can I give pain to another thing? Just as I wouldn't give pain to another human being, I also do not want to give pain to an animal. So he became a vegetarian. So what I'm trying to say is a scientific discovery, scientific understanding, can have such profound influence on our being, on our morality, on what we think, what is right and what is wrong. Am I making my case? Does the example make any sense to you?
Yes.
What I'm trying to tell you is understanding from coming from science can actually help me do things, means reinforce my spirituality in a way which did not happen when thousands of years many people were saying, please, ahimsa, don't do this, don't do that, don't kill this, don't kill that. None of it worked. But one scientific fact open the mind of a person and said, I don't want to do it. So if I want reinforcement of spirituality, then I think one very big asset that we have is actually science. So next things that I will share, and I will just share with you the main results, and I'll try to put the pieces of the puzzle together given the amount of time that I have. But what I'm trying to tell you is this is the part that I'm going... This blue part. This blue part is the one that I'll be emphasizing. So what I'll do is I'll look at the results and insights that are coming up from the side of science and then say how each one reinforces a certain aspect of spirituality that especially that we have been considering in this framework. Okay? Does this sound fair to you? Have I lost all of you at this stage?
No.
Is anybody lost at this stage? You can raise your hand. Okay, that's pretty good. Okay, thank you very much. So now, coming to hardcore facts in science as to where we are going and what how our understanding is changing. So in 2005, one of the most prestigious journals in science, it's called Science itself, by the American Association of Science, that journal conducted a survey of all the top scientists around the world in various fields, and it asked, what are the greatest challenges that science needs to solve in the next 50 years, in any field? And then it took that survey and compiled what these scientists have said, top people from around the world, all kinds of, right from professors to Nobel laureates to everybody. And they came up with two questions as the very top questions scientists have asked. They said, the first greatest challenge we want to solve, science should solve in the next 50 years, is answering this first question, what is the universe made of? Okay? They said, we need to know this. And why did they want to know it? Because that determines when the universe began and how it's going to end. It may not end in your and my lifetime, but it will end sometime. That's what scientists think. So they wanted to know. This is one open question to science that we need to answer. Now the second one is, what is the biological basis for consciousness? In other words, how can matter, you know, Neville has explained this and many others must have already talked about it, how can physical matter develop these qualities of feeling, for example? You know, you pinch an alive body, it says, ouch, it hurts. But when the body is dead, means something is not there in the body or something happened to it, you pinch, there's no response. Okay? So the feeling part, which is the pain part, you cannot give it to something else. I cannot make the table feel pain. I cannot make the table understand my love for it. I cannot make the table make me hate. There's nothing that I can do which will actually make it acquire any of these qualities. So that's what is called consciousness. And the question is, how does this consciousness come about? And scientists have until recently, they have been thinking that it all comes from the brain. It's the brain is somehow producing consciousness. Okay? And we'll figure out how. So anyway, that's the second big question. So I want you to keep this in mind. Two very big questions that science is asking itself. Where did the universe start? Where is it going to end? Number one. And then the second one is, what is the biological basis for consciousness? Now let me share with you just the results. Okay? So the first one, how did the universe come into existence? The prevalent theory is what is called the Big Bang model. Basically, once upon a time, long, long time ago, there was the dawn of time, and there was this Big Bang, big explosion of whatever people can't explain. And from that came primordial matter, and from that then it started coalescing itself and started forming matter with structure. And after some time, then it started forming galaxies and planets and stars and all these kinds of things. And voila, here we are. So this is sort of a timeline that the whole universe started with what is called a Big Bang. And scientists said, ha, we have an explanation now. You religious people, you go and say, God is needed to create the universe. Guess what? We don't need a God because we know how it started. It started with a Big Bang. That was their explanation. But interestingly, this sort of hides the question, because some scientists who are a little bit more clever than the ordinary, they said, but what created the Big Bang? What was there before the Big Bang was the question. Because science always explains, you know, why do you have the table here? The table was here because there was a tree or there was a wood. A carpenter came, he used the wood and he made it into a table. Now you ask, where did the wood come from? You say, oh, there was a tree. And where was the tree come from? Oh, somebody planted the tree. Oh, where did that fellow come from? Oh, his mother and father was there, and therefore he was born. Where did they come from? And then you keep going on. So science, you keep asking questions, what was there before, what caused it? So in a similar way, you can continue asking the question, what was there before that? What was there before the Big Bang? And that became a very big question for science, because there was no answer to it. Okay. Now fast forward, I am now giving you a summary, and there's a reason why I am giving this summary to you. So the question was asked, what was there before the Big Bang? So some of the big heads in science continue to think about this, and most very recently, like here you see in 2011, one of the famous mathematical physicist called Roger Penrose, he actually wrote a book called Cycles of Time. Now, Roger Penrose is a very big shot in terms of the fields of mathematics, mathematical physics, cosmology, and so on. He is actually the one who taught Stephen Hawking. He was the guy who was the doctoral thesis advisor for Stephen Hawking. And if any of you don't know Stephen Hawking, just go and Google, then you will know what we are talking about. He is talked about as the next Einstein, so to say. You know, he's in Cambridge. Penrose is in Oxford, and so he's a very great thinker, and he's very well accomplished scientifically. So he wrote this book, and why I'm pointing this out is he's saying that this Big Bang model, where suddenly a Big Bang happens and the universe comes, does not make any sense. There has to be that the universe expands and then slowly it goes back into a Big Bang once again. So the previous universe leads into the next universe and time continues in a cycle. This is the only conclusion he could come to because there's nothing else that makes sense. Okay, I just want you to keep that in mind. What is he saying? He's saying time is not linear, time has to be cyclic. And the universe always exists, it just goes from a Big Bang to an expansion, then it comes back to a Big Bang once again, a new universe is born out of it. There's no beginning, there is no end. That's basically the conclusion of that. Okay? Now the second one, another one that I'm mentioning is a scientist called Paul Steinhardt, and he is the one who is one of the co-proposers, co-authors of a theory which is the most accepted theory today in cosmology, which is called the inflation theory, a modification of Big Bang. And he looked at his own model that he has proposed, which the whole world has accepted, and said, nah, this doesn't make sense. Okay? So it's a wonderful thing. Look, this scientist has at his heart wanting to find the truth. He is not saying, my theory is accepted by everybody, I am the guru of the world, I am done. He's saying, the solution I came up with is unsatisfactory for so many reasons. Let me go and find out what is the truth behind it. So he came back, and with Neil Chorak, he has written a book in 2007, and he called it Endless Universe Beyond the Big Bang. So the universe has to go endlessly in a cycle. It cannot be starting with a Big Bang. Now, why am I saying it? It's because this guy, by the way, Paul Steinhardt, is the Albert Einstein Professor in Science and Director of the Center of Theoretical Science at Princeton University, where also Einstein worked. So you can't get a better accreditation than that to say that he's one of the big shots in this whole field of trying to understand where this universe came from and where it is going. What are both of them saying? They are saying somehow the universe has to be cyclic, time has to be cyclic. So that's the data number one I want to give to you. Where is science heading today? It's saying somehow this universe has to exist always. It should go in some kind of a cycle. Details are different, I agree. But at least at the bigger picture level, they are saying this is the only thing that makes sense. So keep that in mind as a data point. What's the first data point for you? That the universe always exists. Okay? Nobody creates it. Nobody destroys it. It always exists. And some drama happens in the universe. Okay? Point number one, and time goes in a cycle of some sort. That's item number one. And the connection of that with spirituality, I'll come to it when I cover this point. So the second one now. The second question is, where does consciousness come from? Okay? So far, you are all with me? You okay? All right. So the second one is consciousness. Look, I'm shifting from cosmology to consciousness. Now, in this one also, lots of people, right from philosophers to scientists, lots of people have tried to address this problem, try to understand where does consciousness come from. And the result of it is one guy called David Chalmers, he is a philosopher, but in his doctoral thesis, he came and said, look, all of you guys are arguing about what this consciousness is, till cows come home and you're not making any progress. So let me tell you what the real question you have to answer. And that's his greatest contribution, by the way. Hats off to the guy. Because people started arguing, consciousness means I should be able to think about myself. Consciousness means I should be able to formulate a sentence. Consciousness means I should have this feeling. They were doing all sorts of things, and they were not getting anywhere with any scientific study of consciousness. So this guy came and said, actually, there's only one problem in consciousness that you need to solve, and that's called the hard problem of consciousness. And today, what he has mentioned is taken as the touchstone to actually understand whether anybody solved the problem of consciousness or not. And he's currently a professor in a university in Australia. So, what is that hard problem of consciousness? How does subjective experience come about? Means, how does a feeling of experience, you know, when I see a color, I see a blue colored curtain there, there's a feeling of color blue inside that I'm experiencing. Now, what's funny about it is, when you look at it, you may also call it blue. Okay? You look at a blue colored screen, just like I do, or I'm pointing here, red colored, I say this is red color, and you'll also say, yeah, it's red. But you know what's funny? There is no way for me to know, using any method, whether the sensation I am having is exactly the same sensation you are having. For all you know, you could actually be seeing this in green color, but you have learned to associate the word red with it. Means your sensation is different from my sensation, but we use the same label to describe it. So there's no way I can find out that you are actually seeing something different from me. Now, neuroscience, as they were doing research, they were finding very, very interesting stuff. And one of them is this. Depending upon how the brain gets wired, there's a phenomenon called synesthesia that comes up. You know what happens in synesthesia? If you show somebody a picture, normal people see a picture when you show them a picture. But it can be that in some circumstances, if the brain is rewired differently, when a picture is shown, they won't see a picture, they will hear a sound. Other way around. If you make them hear a sound, they won't see a sound, but they will see a picture. Okay? So subjective experience is a very, very tricky matter. They are not the same. We think, oh, I am saying green, they are saying green. But you have no way of comparing what you are actually feeling with what somebody else is feeling. If this is beyond your head, don't worry about it. But I'm just trying to tell you that he boils down the problem to what is called subjective experience. Feeling, qualia, different words are used. But he said, tell me how this is produced in matter. And that is today still the hardest problem in any field, in neurosciences, in computer sciences, cognitive sciences, philosophy, psychiatry, take it whatever. This is the problem that everybody is trying to address. Now, I want to mention two very famous people who are involved in this. There are many others, but two famous, at two extreme ends of the spectrum. One of them is John Eccles, who is a Nobel Prize winner, is a neuroscientist, and he is the scientist who has found out how the brain cells fire to trigger communication with each other and actually make the brain do what it does. So he did some fantastic work in an area called neurophysiology, the physical functioning of the brain cells. And he got Nobel Prize in 1963. He's a Christian by background, but he believed in the fact that something called a soul is distinct from the brain. Okay? And from 1960s onwards, he tried until 1997 when he died, desperately to prove that the soul or the thinking thing or the feeling thing is actually not in the brain, but it has to be something different from the brain. And none of the scientific community accepted it. And the reason why they didn't accept is because of two things. Not because he's not brainy, not because he was talking wishy-washy things, but because of two things. Number one, he said he espoused the method, the mechanism that people used to say, soul is immaterial, so we don't know where it is in time and space. So immediately it created a problem for science, because you cannot interact with something which is not in time and space. It brings a very big philosophical problem, that you cannot, all science is based upon things that exist in time and space, and governed by laws of physics that are defined within time and space. So if there is anything that exists beyond time and space, it cannot interact with matter. So he wrote very, very good voluminous books, tremendously insightful, scientifically rigorous books as to explain how this immaterial soul might be interacting with the brain. And even today, nobody has excelled him in terms of creating those mechanisms. But still, the scientific community was not convinced, because he was talking about a concept which does not exist in time and space. Okay? So he didn't succeed, and we didn't get anywhere. Now, this new generation that came up is this Francis Crick, is the gentleman I was talking about. He was the Nobel Prize winner. He got Nobel Prize in 1962 for the discovery of DNA. And then he said, I solved the greatest problem of human life. What is this thing about consciousness? It's a piece of cake. But in 1980s, he realized that nobody else was able to solve it. So he jumped onto this problem, and then he started working and created a worldwide movement to scientifically study consciousness. And that is the one which actually led to a lot of insights and advancements in terms of our understanding of the brain and the different regions of the brain which process different kinds of sensory signals and so on and so forth. Now, having done that, he also died in 2004, so about 10 years ago he died. But when he was dying, his regret was, I couldn't solve this problem. This turned out to be much more harder than I had imagined. And this problem of consciousness is actually the hardest problem to solve. Okay? So now I'm saying this fellow is a complete materialist, means consciousness is only in the brain, it's not anywhere else. You just need to cut it off to the minutest degree, and then you will find where consciousness is happening. Both of them failed. Eccles didn't succeed in proving his thing, and Francis Crick didn't succeed in doing his thing. And then there are many others in between. But the conclusion is that nobody found any mechanism in the brain that is conscious. Nowhere in the brain there is a spot that is conscious. So where do we go from here? What is producing consciousness inside of you? So currently science thinks about it this way. It says either everything is conscious, which is a model called pantheism, but if enough units of these conscious entities come together, they become complex communication mechanisms, then consciousness comes out the way we are seeing. If they are not complex, it is not there, then it won't be conscious. So table has consciousness, but has very little, so you don't see it exhibit any of the behaviors you want. That's one thinking, and we know it's going to fail. Okay? Because this is the last resort for them, saying we didn't find anywhere in the brain, so it must be all over in very small quantity. The other side, now scientists are softening to say, well, now there's only one possibility left. Probably there is something that must have the property of consciousness. Okay? This is where the world stands today. And I want to share with you a couple of slides which basically talk about results that are just about coming out. And so they are not published work yet. But I can guarantee you, in 2016, you'll hear about it in the news. Okay? 99.9999%. So what is that about? And that is this. So what's the source of consciousness? People try to investigate the source of where that consciousness is in different parts of the brain. And finally now, actually we are at a stage, and lots of scientists are converging on this, that there is a very small region in what is called the upper brainstem. This part is what I'm talking about. There's one very small region which is amenable to a very specific kind of particle, a new kind of a particle, like an electron, new kind of a particle, which has the property of consciousness to sit and actually control the whole of the brain. Okay? So when this result comes out, then that gentleman who asked this question in the previous session, he said he liked the whole presentation that Neville has given, but he said, I'm confused, I don't know where the soul is. What did you ask? Who was the gentleman who asked that question? Yes. Here is your answer. That's where it is. This is where science is coming to. Okay? So, there is a small region within the brain from which it has connectivity to the rest of the brain to actually control it and therefore the body. So, if you ask where the soul sits, basically it's somewhere within that region. I'm not giving precise details for a specific reason because this is work yet to come out, and when it comes out you will see it. I can't say anything more on that matter, but this model that you have been hearing, that we are a point of light, we are focused, we sit somewhere in the brain and actually control it, that you have been hearing in this organization, I am telling you, science is moving there, and this confirmation will happen in 2016. Okay? So that's the science side of the second element of the spirit. We talked about another element, behavior. We said behavior is the domain of what? Behavior is the domain of religion, typically. Okay? So now let me share a couple of slides on this aspect, and then I'll try to wrap up, because I'm coming to the end of it. Neuroscience, means brain sciences, is finding that in our behavior, whatever we do, we go through a process which is called, which is like a balance, like a scale. And in that one, one side of a brain tries to reason about things that it sees, that it knows, that it understands. Another side of the brain actually deals with the emotion that we generate as a being, as a spiritual being. Okay? So in any situation, you will always find this dilemma. Actually, this is the reason why when we try to make a decision, we always find that we are going this way. Okay? Let me give you a simple example. You saw chocolate, and you want to eat chocolate. How many of you want to eat chocolate? Few of you, not many. Okay. All right. So your emotion says, chocolate, yummy, I want to eat. Okay? That's this side of the scale. And what does the other side do? It reasons. What does it reason? What does it say? Chocolate means you are going to become fat. Oh my God, you are going to get a heart attack. Or you will put on so much weight that your lover will not love you anymore. I can't do that. So now you have a dilemma between the two. Even if you want to get out of your chair, there will be this questioning going on. It's so comfortable and cozy here, let me sit in the chair. Other thing will say, if I don't get up and switch on that thing, something else is going to happen, so I should get up. So there's this dilemma for us at every moment by moment, we go through this dilemma in the brain. There's emotion versus reason. So if you are only guided by emotion, that means you are not using reason. And you know people who are just driven by emotion, what do you call them? Somebody is very emotional, they are not listening to you. Even if you are telling them this is not good, this is going to happen, they don't listen. What do you call them? Emotional fools. You will also call them unreasonable. See, the reason is gone down the drain and they are just driven by this side of the scale. So you say they are unreasonable. Whereas some people, they put this one aside and they are only driven by logic and reason. What do you call them? Emotionless, okay. Another word. What do you call them?
Logic.
No. Somebody use that word. You said they're cold. You know, they said this one is cold. It's like he has no emotions. Do you like being with somebody who is cold? No. Actually, there's a whole field called emotional intelligence being taught to leaders, because if you don't pay attention to this part, forget about actually having them along with you. So you need both sides. And what neuroscience is telling us now is that actually they need to be in balance. You need to see both sides of it. But you can be trained to get that balance. You can be trained to get that balance. This is the third element that I want to say. And Neville was mentioning about neuroplasticity. If you train yourself in a particular way, the brain rewires itself and you can actually become a more balanced being. Be it a leader, be it a husband, be it a wife, be it a parent, whatever it is, you can be a better being. But training is needed for that. Okay, quickly running through, these are the parts of the brain which get involved in the two balances. So one side is the reason, this side is the reason, this side is the emotion, right side and left side. So what does Raja Yoga do to you? I'm not wrapping it up, I'm just connecting the pieces. So just bear with me for a couple of minutes. When you are told to do Raja Yoga meditation, what really happens to you is you are actually reinforcing the emotional side of you. The circuitry that deals with the emotion is the part which actually gets reinforced when you experience those positive emotions through meditation. That's the reason why the Raja Yoga part has meditation as a component. What's the other component of Raja Yoga? You have been hearing lots of beautiful lectures. Sister Shivani and many others have been talking to you a lot of stuff. And that gives you the knowledge part. And what does the knowledge part do to you? It helps you balance your reasoning part. So you work out the emotional side, bring it into a healthy state. You work out the reasoning side, bring it into a healthy state. You became somebody in a properly balanced state, and together they help restore balance. So this is the science behind what is taught here. Of course, it's not taught by these people. They just tell you the method, but I'm telling you this is actually confirmed by science today. Neuroscience is coming to this conclusion that this is what you need. Now, since the science and spirituality aspect is there, I'm throwing you a couple of slokas. See the sloka number 2, chapter number 2, verse 12 in the Gita. It says, it's not that I have never existed, nor thou, means nor you. It's not that I have never existed, nor you, nor these kings. Nor is it that we shall ever cease to exist in the future. It's a statement from Gita. What is it saying? I will always exist, you will always exist. So for you to always exist, time has to be what? Time has to be a cycle. Now that's the connection with the research that I shared with you, that these top scientists in the world are saying the universe has to exist eternally. It's not like it's going to finish or it started with a big bang. So that's the confirmation. You already have it in the Gita that it's going to be there forever. But for us it just became, oh, it's a religious book, forget about it. Today I want my job, today I want my something else. So we're driven by all the material stuff where the wisdom was actually lying in there. Now the next one, the self. This is about the self, the being. The self, weapons cannot cut it, fire does not burn it, water does not wet it, wind does not dry it. So what is that thing? It's the thing which is not the matter, which is not the body, which is not the brain. It's talking about the soul. And that element that I pointed out to in that part of the brain where I said it sits here, that is exactly the one which has these properties. It cannot be changed into anything else. So there's a law of conservation in science which basically tells you that there are certain things which cannot be destroyed or created. So consciousness is one such thing. So the self always exists. That's the second one. So, summary, spirituality can help and is helping science, but science can now help spirituality. But when you have both of them together, that's when you can actually eliminate the negative consequences of them. And so you now have the third ellipse, which would be what? Having both sides of it together in it. That's basically the Raja Yoga that you have been hearing. Okay? What does science do? Science is all about knowing. What is spirituality? It's all about being. And so what is this dude in here? This is about becoming. You know, you be, and you actually become. And that's what Raja Yoga helps you to become, a divine being. So, last verse. This verse says, it's a prayer from the Upanishad called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And what it says, many of you might know this, Asatoma Sadgamaya, Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityorma Amrutangamaya. What does it mean? From falsehood, lead me to truth. From darkness, lead me to light. From death, lead me to immortality. Okay? So, what is the thing which will lead you to truth? What's the thing that leads you to truth? Whose goal is to just study truth?
Science.
So, that's the first part. Once you got the truths, how to apply them and actually change yourself, in the right way of behavior, that's the spirituality. From darkness into light, that's the spiritual part. And once you understood the ultimate truth, that I am the eternal being, then what happens to you, the soul? You become immortal. So the prayer is answered. Basically, that's what the union of science and spirituality is about. And we are at the cusp of seeing this in the world happening, and I shared with you some of the main things that we see coming up in the scientific world, which will actually help us strengthen the spiritual element. And when we do follow that method, then the golden age will be created. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Surya.